No one can read the records in the Sacco Vanzetti case with an open mind and not come to the conclusion that Niccolò Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti were doomed to the electric chair because of official prejudices against them as Italian working men and as so-called radicals.
I'm Joanne Allen for The Past Present, History for Public Radio. In the next hour, we'll retell the remarkable story of Niccolò Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti. In the 1920s, the case of Sacco and Vanzetti aroused the passions of the nation and the world.
Defenders of Sacco and Vanzetti have always portrayed them as, quote, philosophical anarchists. That's either philosophical anarchists or avowed pacifists. This is all nonsense. These were dedicated militant revolutionaries.
On today's program, a conversation with historian Nunzio Pernacconi is interspersed with music about Sacco and Vanzetti, excerpts from their famous prison letters read by actors, and historical audio of men who were involved in the Sacco-Vanzetti case.
The degree and the passion of the feeling, not only in Moscow, but this was all over Europe.
Ingiusta, sì, perché tutti sanno che al momento della tragedia i due poveri condannati Sacco e Vanzetti si trovavano molto lontani dal posto del delitto.
I can only imagine what Vanzetti went through when he saw the lights in his cell, trembling, telling him that his brother was gone.
The crowd gathered when the word was coming across that they were being executed, and there was weeping in the street.
Who will remember the hands so white and fine that touched the finest linen, that poured the finest wine? Who will remember the genteel words they spoke that named the lives of two good men? A nuisance or a joke?
When Sacco and Vanzetti were executed in 1927, they became martyrs to left-wing political movements around the world. Their supporters said the two men were convicted of a crime they never committed, the payroll robbery and murder of two security guards in the Boston suburb of South Braintree.
I think they are symbols of American justice at its worst.
Nunzio Pernacconi is a scholar of Italian anarchism at Drexel University.
This is compounded by the fact that after 7 years of incarceration, these men really became heroic figures. Their stature, both intellectually, morally, politically, was such that their cause was embraced by literally hundreds of thousands of people.
Most of their supporters were unaware of what historians now believe, that before their arrest for the South Braintree murders, Sacco and Vanzetti were part of a group of Italian anarchists that conducted a bombing campaign against government officials.
Both Sacco and Vanzetti were at least peripherally involved in the bombing campaign. As to something specific, what they did with one or the other, it's not certain.
In part one of our program, Nunzio Pernacconi talks with Leonard Lopate about the anarchist background of Sacco and Vanzetti and about the leading Italian anarchist in America, Luigi Galliani. In part two, we move to the Red Scare and the Palmer Raids following World War I, when the U.S. government suppressed the labor movement and deported foreign-born radicals, and when Italian anarchists like Sacco and Vanzetti struck back with a bombing campaign. And in part three, we bring in a second historian, Richard Pollenberg, for a documentary segment about the crime, trial, and punishment of Sacco and Vanzetti. Stay with us.
Addio, Lucano bella, o dolce terra pia.
Let me try to make you understand the philosophy that's called anarchism all over the world.
Part one of our program, the anarchist background of Sacco and Vanzetti. Nunzio Pernacconi spoke with Leonard Lopate, a public radio talk show host in New York City.
Tell us a little about Sacco and Vanzetti, what their lives were like in Italy and why they came to America.
Both were of peasant stock. Vanzetti from the northern region of Piedmont, Sacco from the southern region of Puglia. In both instances, their fathers were fairly prosperous peasants. owning land, vineyards, olive oil manufacture, and there was no economic motive for their coming to the United States. In the case of Sacco, it really was a kind of young man looking for adventure, and he came to the States with his brother. Vanzetti's case was a little bit more tragic insofar as his mother, to whom he was absolutely devoted, had recently died of a dreadful bout of cancer. And as he put it later on, he wanted to put the ocean between himself and where he came from.
And how was America responding to immigrants in those days? Was it hostile to all immigrant groups or particularly to Italian immigrants?
I'd say it was hostile to all immigrant groups, the so-called new immigrants across the board. The Italians, however, found themselves really on the bottom rung. I think you have to understand this in terms of the form of racism which prevailed in the United States, which is really something called Nordicism. The assumption on the part of the established order was that there was a racial hierarchy with Nordics, i.e. Scandinavians, Germans, Anglo-Saxons, at the top and going down from there, Alpine, Mediterranean. Italians were categorized not only as Mediterranean, but in the case of Southern Italians, frequently they were not even considered white.
There were even lynchings of Italians, weren't there?
There were from about 1874 to about 1915, there were 39 lynchings. The most famous case was 1891 in New Orleans, when 11 Sicilians were lynched.
Now, Sacco and Vanzetti were peasants, as you say, so that means, I imagine, that they didn't speak any English when they got here. How did they make out?
Well, you were basically living in subcultures. The amount of English you had to know was just enough to basically deal with your employer.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you were working in an Italian neighborhood.
That's right.
Living in an Italian
neighborhood. All of your friends, all of your social contacts, the stores in which you would shop, so on and so forth, would be Italian.
But Sacco did a lot better than Vanzetti. Why?
It's hard to know why. Sacco, from the start, even back in Puglia, was very mechanically oriented. He liked tinkering with machines. He was a hard worker. And he was not troubled, I would say, by the kind of emotional difficulties that Vanzetti had experienced with his mother's death. When he came over, he made up his mind rather quickly that he was not going to settle just for the menial jobs that were available to most Italians. And therefore, he took a course, I think it was about $50 to take this course, and he learned how to become an edge trimmer in a shoe factory, which in those days was fairly good money. And he worked overtime. He also served as a kind of, actually a night watchman, but he would stoke the furnace during the wintertime, come in late at night. So he was ambitious and he made fairly good money. He had in excess of $1,500 in savings when this tragedy overcame him.
And Vanzetti actually had a skill. He was a skilled pastry chef, but he preferred to work as a casual laborer?
Skilled pastry chef sounds more than it actually was. He was apprenticed in Italy to become a pastry chef. What that meant in reality was 15-hour days, sometimes 18-hour days, working in restaurants, in pastry shops, but in the most menial capacity imaginable. And when he came here, he had no luck whatsoever. And don't forget, both came over in 1908, which was in the midst of an economic depression in the United States. Mm-hmm. And from day one, Vanzetti simply had a very tough time of it, one menial job after another.
Vanzetti sold fish around the Plymouth Harbor. Sacco was a shoe factor's best shoe cutter. All of my sons, all of my daughters, they're gonna help me sing your name. Oh, ho, Sacco, Sacco. Hey, Bart Vanzetti, your wife and kids and all your family, I just want to sing your name.
Sacco married and eventually had two children, while Vanzetti remained a bachelor all his life. Though Vanzetti had little formal education, he was a bookish man, reading everything from Dante and Tolstoy to political tracts by anarchists Peter Kropotkin and Errico Malatesta. His English was never perfect, but in the letters he later wrote from prison, his language comes across as awkwardly tender poetry. Here's part of a letter Vanzetti wrote to Alfonsina Brini, his former landlady and a close friend. Zora is Mrs. Brini's little daughter.
Dear Alfonsina, I heartily laugh to hear that the fingernails of the little cat have scratched Zora's nose, and I continue to laugh every time I think about it. Surely it is a good lesson not only for Zora and other child, but for mankind. The little cat knows very well it has a sharp nails, and that when a little girl molests it, it is enough to scratch a little her nose for be let free. People, too, has sharp fingernails. And the noses of tyrants and oppressors is make of flesh, too. Oh, how much less sorrowness and misery would be among the mortals if they know just what a little cat knows.
Once again, historian Nunzio Pernacconi in conversation with Leonard Lopate.
They weren't anarchists when they first came
to
this country.
No, neither one were anarchists.
So what drew them to the anarchist movement?
Well, a kind of empirical transition from their former views to more radical came really as a consequence of their exposure to the realities of working-class life in the United States, particularly if you were an immigrant. Right? Conditions circa 1912, 13, when they become radicalized, were absolutely grotesque.
Still, there we have Sacco doing very well at his job, liked by the boss. He seems like an unlikely candidate.
Well, that's because I think it's incorrect to see someone professing a radical ideology simply as a consequence of economic hardship. Sacco sincerely believed, despite his own relative success, that conditions were horrible, that the poor were oppressed, and it was this emotional contact that he had, that he felt for these people, that really was key in his conversion.
Sacco tried to explain his political passions in a letter he wrote to his six-year-old daughter only a few weeks before he was executed.
My dear Ines, it was the greatest treasure and sweetness in my struggling life that I could have lived with you and your brother Dante and your mother in a neat little farm and learn all your sincere words and tender affection. The same I have wished to see for other poor girls and their brothers, happy with their mother and father, as I dreamed for us. But it was not so, and the nightmare of the lower classes saddened very badly your father's soul.
What was the popular image of anarchists in the 1910s when Sacco and Vanzetti started becoming active in the movement?
The popular image of anarchists was that of a wild-eyed, bearded, maniacal miscreant with a bomb in one hand and a dagger between his teeth and a pistol in the other hand. This was an image which was really cultivated and nurtured from the 1870s on. What's happening by the time you get to the pre-World War I period is this belief that anarchists are by definition criminal. Theodore Roosevelt talked about anarchists as the enemy of humanity, the enemy of mankind. The Washington Post in 1908 called for the death penalty for all anarchists.
We'd already passed a law preventing anarchists from coming into this country.
Several laws. They weren't terribly effective at this point. But what you have, and this is a longstanding, ongoing process, the identification of anarchists with criminality.
And but to some degree, the anarchists were responsible for that, weren't they?
Well, when we talk about the anarchist, bear in mind that you're talking about a movement that had thousands of disciples, and the number of people who engaged in terrorism were probably less than 100.
But there were some high-profile incidents.
Yes,
the Haymarket Square explosion.
Sure.
In the 1880s. Then in 1892, Alexander Berkman, the lover of Emma Goldman, shot and wounded Henry Clay Frick,
right,
who ran Andrew Carnegie Steel Empire. In 1901, an anarchist, Leon Czolgosz, assassinated the president of the United States,
right,
William McKinley.
Yeah, the anarchists, unfortunately, have never been able to surmount the negative stereotype that resulted from a few acts of terrorism that they did perpetrate. To understand it, you have to think in terms of what does the word mean? And, of course, from the Greek, meaning no government. What they're arguing is that any form of government, any state, any form of organized authority inevitably is authoritarian and oppressive. What they believed was that man is fundamentally socialist. It's not a question that they were naive enough to believe that all men are inherently good and that society is the corrupting force. The corrupting forces were the institutions of private property and the state. Eliminate these two, and you can have a society based on justice and equality.
You're listening to The Past Present, History for Public Radio. Our program features conversations with historians, accompanied by historical audio, dramatic readings by actors, and music.
Music. furono arrestati. Appostano una sera contrapresa, d'aver ucciso pure l'accusati, e per verdetto furono in attesa. Ma tutto il mondo in sala.
Sacco and Vanzetti took to anarchism with an almost religious fervor. In a letter written from prison, Vanzetti briefly describes his passion for what he called his beautiful idea.
Oh, friend, the anarchism is as beauty as a woman for me, perhaps even more, since it include all the rest and me and her. Calm, serene, honest, natural, virile, muddy, and celestial at once. Austere, heroic, fearless, fatal, generous, and implacable. All these, and more it is.
Anarchists like Sacco and Vanzetti distinguished themselves from communists, whom they regarded as rivals for the sympathy of the workers. The conflict between anarchists and communists went back to 1872, when Russian anarchist Mikhail Bakunin tried to wrest control of the International Working Men's Association from Karl Marx. Again, in conversation with Leonard Lopate, Nunzio Pernacconi.
Essentially, what you're talking about here, and basically they're still using the generic term socialism in those days, was a clash between an authoritarian form of socialism a la Marx or an anti-authoritarian form of socialism a la Bakunin.
But Marx did talk about the withering away of the state.
Well, the anarchists believe that was a crock, that no state is going to wither away, whether it is a bourgeois state, a feudal state, or a worker state.
They didn't put very much faith in electoral politics. Like the communists, they all considered themselves revolutionaries.
There was no form of participation in the state or political activities that was acceptable. You were automatically corrupted if you engaged in these practices.
What would happen after you got rid of private property, government, laws, courts, and police? How would things get made? How would bridges get built and crops farmed and children educated?
The assumption behind this is what Kropotkin called mutual aid. He assumed that in a post-revolutionary society, humanity would understand that it was in its own interest to cooperate, to do things voluntarily, to build bridges if that were necessary, to dig ditches, to sweep up the refuse. Rather than all of these being odious tasks, the assumption was that it's necessary to be done and everybody's going to pitch in and do it. Anarchists were always strongest for their critique of existing society. Here is where you find the best intellectual arguments that are put forward as to the inherent oppressive nature of the state or the evils of private property. More of their treatises are devoted to these issues, what is wrong with existing society and the way to fix it. Bear in mind that if you were to come up with blueprints and have a kind of formula already spelled out, that in and of itself would be looked upon as an authoritarian mode.
But how do we get from this kind of idealism to the terrorists who are killing leaders of countries, in many cases, killing innocent people in terrorist activities, similar to the sorts of things we see with the IRA?
Actually, not that much terrorism was aimed at innocent people. Right? These are often, in the parlance of the American military, collateral damage. Terrorism, you have to see as a function of the decline of the movement by 1881. At the International Anarchist Conference in London in 1881, they advocated studying, quote, chemistry. Right? Euphemism, of course, for bombs. But that was really a function of their inability to rebel in a collective mode. They had tried insurrections, particularly in Italy in the 1870s, and they didn't work. The masses did not respond. So it really was a function of weakness that certain anarchists resorted to terrorism.
Before America entered World War I, Sacco and Vanzetti were drawn into the orbit of Luigi Galiani, the leading Italian anarchist in America.
Galiani and many of the people who become significant in the movement really kind of proved their mettle in the 1890s when the Italian government rounded up and incarcerated literally 90% of them. Galiani certainly was a fanatic and he was authoritarian, but this was really a man with tremendous courage. When the anarchists were approached by a sympathetic socialist deputy in 1899 with the idea that they can help fight the reaction in Italy by putting up somebody like Malatesta as a protest candidate, Galiani basically said, "The faith remains the same. If we have to stay here 1,000 years, if it means rejecting or besmirching our beliefs, even, you know, one iota, better to remain here forever." So there was an absolute diehard militancy that was born in the 1890s, and that is what's brought over by somebody like Galiani.
How did this figure in the lives of Sacco and Vanzetti? Did they go to meetings and in some kind of anarchist club?
Oh, absolutely. Sacco and Vanzetti are classic militant rank and file. When they embraced this, they did so with their entire heart and soul and devoted themselves and ultimately their lives to the movement. You had literally hundreds of Italian anarchist groups scattered throughout the United States. There was virtually no state that did not have one kind of group or another. Massachusetts was what you would call really Galiani territory. This is where Galiani had his strongest following. And in all of the little towns scattered in Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, you had anarchist groups. And Sacco and Vanzetti both gravitated towards these groups.
And then there would be...
And all the activities would entail gathering funds to support the movement's newspaper, Galiani's Cronica Sovversiva. If there was a strike in progress, you would gather funds through various means to contribute to the workers' strike fund. There were all kinds of social activities. Picnics were a standard mode of getting together. There were amateur plays put on by what we call the Filodrammatica, a group of amateur actors who would put on politically oriented plays, frequently anti-clerical in nature.
Sacco later described in a letter the camaraderie he felt toward his fellow anarchists.
"My dear friend, Mrs. Jack, I remember when I came back from Mexico sometime into the middle of September 1917, and at that time I was unoccupied. So, in one lovely morning of September, when the rays of sunshine are still warm in the soul of oppressed humanity, I was looking for a job around the city of Boston, and away I was going towards the south of Boston, I met one of my most dear comrades. And just as soon as we saw each other, we ran one into the embrace of the other, and we kissed each other on both sides of the cheeks. And yet it was not a very long time since we had seen each other, because a few weeks before we were in Mexico together. But this spontaneous affection, it shows at all times in the heart of one who has reciprocal love and sublime faith, and such a remembrance it will never disappear in the heart of the proletarian."
I'm Joanne Allen, and you're listening to The Past Present, History for Public Radio. Today's program is about Sacco and Vanzetti, Italian immigrants who were executed in 1927 for a crime they probably did not commit. Now for part two of our program, The Red Scare and the Violent Reaction.
"In the coming conflict with the Bolsheviki, the Allies need the aid of Germany, which is in a position geographically and otherwise to be a strong bulwark against the Russian horde.
We were arrested because we were radicals. At the time, we were all German spies. Then we became all Bolshevik.
They bring foreign ideas and ideals into our land, threatening our unity through a foreign propaganda that is boring into the heart fibers of our national character."
Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti did not meet until 1917, on the eve of the American entry into World War I. Once again, historian Nunzio Pernacconi in conversation with Leonard Lopate.
You mentioned earlier that during World War I, both Sacco and Vanzetti went to Mexico with a group of fellow anarchists.
Yes.
What were they hoping to find there?
Mexico was simply a place of exile. After the Conscription Act was passed in 1917, Galeani realized that this would put many of his followers in a tenuous position. Even if, as aliens, they were not immediately eligible to be drafted, nevertheless, that would mean that they would have to register with the government, that their identities would be known, and who knows what could happen a year or two down the road. And therefore, he suggested that they, and he did this in very oblique language, that they resist this in whatever form possible. Many simply went underground in the United States, and this group of about 50 or 60 of his followers did go to Mexico. But again, bear in mind, it's not just avoidance of the draft, but this hope and this intention that when the revolution erupted in Italy, they would be able to go back and participate.
How long did they stay?
4, 5, 6 months tops, depending who you're talking about.
So when they
came, life there was very difficult. They couldn't find work. Conditions were very primitive. And in the case, for example, of Sacco, he has his wife back in the United States, and he missed her enormously. And it was really one hardship after another. And finally, when they realized that the revolution was not going to take place in Italy, they gradually drifted back into the United States.
And they came back to the Red Scare and the Palmer Raids.
Well, the Red Scare and the Palmer Raids, bear in mind that this wave of political reaction and repression really begins with the entry into the war in 1917. The IWW was targeted literally within a month or two of the United States declaration of war. This was seized as an opportunity both by the federal government, by corporate magnates, by patriotic organizations to really settle accounts with the left, be it alien or American, once and for all. This is a kind of act of preventive counter-revolution, and it extends from 17 through 1920. The Red Scare, so-called 1919-1920, is simply the last phase of that process. People like Hoover, like Palmer, I don't think they were bright enough to realize that the Red Menace was more fantasy than reality. There was no revolutionary potential for the United States in this period. Bear in mind that there's a reciprocal relationship between war and revolution in modern times. You only have revolution after war gets through demolishing the state and uprooting the entire social order. The Russian Revolution comes out of the bowels of defeat and intense turmoil. Nothing like that was going on in the United States. The state was all powerful. You had every imaginable form of police machinery at your disposal to crush anything should it get out of hand.
So Italian radicals weren't singled out as targets for arrest and deportation?
Oh, yes, they were. In fact, the legislation passed in 1917, if memory serves, specifically discussed Galeani's group because they were seen as amongst the most dangerous in the United States. In fact, some of the Justice Department documents refer to him as the most dangerous anarchist in the United States and his newspaper Cronaca Sovversiva as the most seditious sheet published in the United States.
If a policeman or an agent of the Department of Justice came in your house and he find a copy of the New York Call or the, any other publication that wasn't kosher, that was enough to be arrested and to be deported.
Luigi Quintiliano, a union leader who later helped organize the legal defense of Sacco and Vanzetti, recalled the atmosphere of oppression in 1919. He spoke at a 1967 church meeting.
And we used to disappear every night. We used to mad in little stores in the house of a friend. We were scared to death. We couldn't get no lawyers. We had no money. We were arrested because we were radicals. At the time, we were all German spies. Then we became all Bolshevik. Nobody asked us what we were, what we want. But they just give us name. During the war, German spies. After the war, Bolsheviks. So, deportation right and left, by the hundred.
Have to bear in mind, deportation really was a function of the Labor Department, not the Justice Department. justice could investigate and ultimately arrest, but it was a function of the Labor Department to actually deport you. And this was an administrative act, not a judicial one. There was no trial. There's no legal representation. It's simply a matter of if you meet certain criteria, fill out the paperwork, and you're on the next boat out of here.
Galliani himself was deported to Italy, leaving behind his wife and five children. His followers didn't take the repression lying down. In April of 1919, 30 bombs were mailed to the homes of government officials and business leaders, including Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes and Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer.
I think it has to be conceived of in terms of retaliation. They'd have no hope of precipitating revolution by this. It stemmed from their belief that the state has no right to a monopoly of violence, and if it uses violence against the people, that they have the legitimate right to respond in kind and are morally justified in so doing.
None of the mail bombs killed its intended target, but one managed to blow off the hands of the black maid of former Senator Thomas Hardwick. Hardwick was known for his anti-immigrant rhetoric when he served as chairman of the Senate Committee on Immigration. A clerk in the New York General Post Office read about the Hardwick bombing in the morning papers while riding the subway home after a late-night shift. He recognized the description of the bomb's packaging. 3 days earlier, he had set aside 16 such packages for insufficient postage. He hurried back to the post office. The police were summoned, and the bombs were defused. A few weeks later, on June 2, 1919, explosions took place in seven eastern cities, including Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C. Once again, Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer was a target.
Why is Palmer the target? He is the prime mover of this repression in 1919-1920, part of it having to do with his presidential aspirations. If he could position himself as the slayer of the Red Dragon, he might conceivably be a shoo-in for president, and which is why he was targeted. And yes, June 2nd, 1919, and this is really the beginning of the Sacco-Vanzetti case, one of the Gallianisti named Carlo Valdinoci was planting a bomb outside of Palmer's house, and either the fuse went off prematurely or he tripped. Nobody knows what happened, but he is blown to smithereens together with Palmer's house. And as a result of a leaflet that was found and pieced together, eventually the Justice Department will trace this back to this anarchist print shop in Brooklyn, New York, which was run by two people, Andrea Salcedo and Roberto Elia.
Salcedo was a friend of Vanzetti's. Agents of the Justice Department held Salcedo and Elia incommunicado for several weeks at a federal building in Lower Manhattan. After being beaten, Salcedo apparently cracked and informed on his fellow anarchists. Early in the morning on May 3, 1920, while still in custody, Salcedo fell to his death from the 14th floor. Luigi Quintiliano was then secretary of the Italian Committee for Political Victims.
Salcedo didn't commit a suicide. Salcedo was thrown out of a window because they had beat him so bad. They want names out of him. They want story out of him, which he couldn't give.
Well, the leading authority on this, Paul Average, who has examined the window ledge there on the 14th floor, and he said it would be almost impossible for two or three agents to toss out a struggling victim. It seems far more likely that he was just oppressed by guilt at having betrayed his comrades and committed suicide. The anarchists, of course, never believed this. To them, it was him being tossed out the window by the feds.
The newspapers were filled with reports of Salcedo's suicide and confession. Vanzetti came to New York from Boston to find out what had happened to his friend. Sacco, meanwhile, was told by his employer that the Bureau of Investigation had been asking questions about him. He made arrangements to return to Italy with his wife and child. There is still no definitive evidence linking Sacco and Vanzetti to the bombing campaign of 1919, but Pernacconi cites the work of historian Paul Average.
Professor Average has done extensive research on this question, and it is his opinion that both Sacco and Vanzetti were at least peripherally involved in the bombing campaign. As to something specific, what they did, if one or the other, it's not certain. The evidence seems to point more towards Vanzetti even than Sacco, which is interesting because it's usually thought that Sacco was the more inherently violent of the two. But on the basis of the little evidence that does exist, there's some suggestion that Vanzetti was involved in a bombing in Youngstown.
How might Sacco and Vanzetti have justified their apparent involvement in political violence? Richard Pollenberg is professor of history at Cornell University.
If you asked Sacco and Vanzetti, how could they, given their views of humanity and nature and loving kindness and peacefulness, how could they have this implacable hatred of the system and a willingness to commit violent acts to overthrow it? Their answer, like the answer of other anarchists, would be, I think, something as follows. Compared to the horrors committed by the ruling class, compared to the slaughter, let's say, associated with World War I, the violence that they were part of was just infinitesimal compared to that. A few small acts of revolutionary violence, in their view, would usher in a new system.
I'll tell you if you ask me about this payroll robbery. Two clerks is killed by the shoe factory on the street in South Braintree. Judge there told his friends around that he had cut the radicals down. Anarchist bastard was the name Judge Thayer called these two good men. Two good men's a long time gone. Two good men's a long time gone. Two good men's a long time gone. Left me here to sing this song.
Part three of our program, The Crime, the Trial, and the Punishment. On May 5, 1919, Sacco and Vanzetti were arrested together on a streetcar in Brockton, Massachusetts.
When Sacco and Vanzetti were arrested, they had no idea that they were being charged with robbery or with murder. They thought that they were being picked up, as many of their comrades had been, because of their radical activities. And the questions all had to do with their beliefs, with their anarchism, with those kinds of activities. Consequently, they did not tell the police the truth about where they had been and what they were doing and even why they were armed. They were afraid that if they told the truth, they would implicate themselves and, worse yet, implicate some of their friends in the movement.
Sacco and Vanzetti were suspects in two separate crimes. The first took place on the morning of December 24, 1919. Nunzio Pernacconi.
There was an attempted robbery of a shoe factory in December. The job was botched. Some assailants were approaching this truck on foot, opened fire, and the truck sped away, and finally they just ran off. All of this happens within the span of just a few minutes.
Sacco had an ironclad alibi and was not prosecuted. On December 24th, he had punched his time card at the factory where he worked. Vanzetti also had an apparently incontestable alibi. He said he had been selling Christmas eels to Italians in North Plymouth, Massachusetts, where he lived. The defense marshaled many Italian witnesses to vouch for him, but Italians were viewed by the jury as unreliable. So Vanzetti was convicted, and Judge Webster Thayer sentenced him to 15 years, the maximum penalty for attempted robbery.
Who will remember Judge Webster Thayer? One hand on the gavel, the other resting on his chair. Hateful words he said, speaking to the living in the language of the dead. And all who know.
Judge Thayer also presided over the second trial that would eventually send Sacco and Vanzetti to the electric chair. On April 15, 1920, bandits had killed two employees of the Slater and Morrill Shoe Company in the Boston suburb of South Braintree. The assailants escaped in a getaway car with $15,000. Nunzio Pernacconi explains why Sacco and Vanzetti became suspects in the case.
The police chief, Michael Stewart, had been involved in the rounding up of radicals for deportation. So in his view, to be a radical, meant to be a criminal. And in investigating the crime, he simply, by a kind of cognitive leap, decided on his own, on the basis of no evidence whatsoever, that the perpetrators were anarchists and Italians. And therefore, when his suspicions were subsequently aroused in regard to one of Sacco Vanzetti's comrades, Colacci, and also Buda, this to him was proof positive that this was a gang of Italian anarchists who had committed both crimes. But this is simply his imagination putting all this together. There was nothing to indicate that that was the case.
The case against them was strengthened by the fact that Sacco and Vanzetti had been found carrying pistols when they were arrested.
What were they up to? Perhaps they were hiding literature, as they claimed. Some people, starting with Upton Sinclair, stated that it was in all likelihood they might have been hiding dynamite that night. And we certainly cannot exclude that possibility. And if it was literature, in all likelihood, part of the literature was this bomb manual.
They did act as if they were guilty because they thought they were being arrested for something that, in fact, had nothing to do with what they were finally charged with.
One pillar of the prosecution's case was this so-called consciousness of guilt when they were arrested. Richard Pollenberg explains the case against Sacco and Vanzetti.
There was evidence connecting them to the crime. The evidence was somewhat better in Sacco's case than it was in Vanzetti's case. But in my view, the evidence was tainted evidence, and the prosecution knew that. There were some eyewitnesses who placed both Sacco and Vanzetti at the scene of the crime. There were many other eyewitnesses, though, who could not place them there and whom the prosecution just ignored or let go. The defense never knew about them. Some of the eyewitnesses were people who had been coached or who had been encouraged to say that they saw Sacco and Vanzetti there. When the eyewitnesses identified Sacco and Vanzetti, they did not have to pick them out of a lineup in which other men were also present. Instead, they observed them in their cells. Sometimes the police would ask Sacco and Vanzetti to strike a pose as if they were holding a gun to aid in the identification. And so the eyewitness testimony was certainly not good testimony. There also was testimony concerning the pistol found at the scene of the crime. But in that case, the prosecution knew that the pistol that it claimed was Vanzetti's gun could not, in fact, have been Vanzetti's gun. It's just that the prosecution did not make that information available to the defense, as in a modern case, the prosecution would be obligated to do.
We have irrefutable proof that the foreman of the jury referred to our Italians as guineas and dagos, and that if he had his way, he would not let any of them into America.
Michael Musmano was a conservative young lawyer on Sacco and Vanzetti's defense team.
There was irrefutable proof that the trial judge, Webster Thayer, referred to the defense as anarchistic bastards, and that before charging the jury in the case said that he would get them hanged. We have the uncontested proof that before the foreman of the jury had heard a word of testimony, he said to a friend, "Damn them, they ought to hang anyway."
Richard Pollenberg and Nunzio Pernacconi differ about how anti-Italian prejudice affected the verdict. First Pollenberg, then Pernacconi.
Even if the jury was not prejudiced, even if the jury just weighed the evidence that was presented, a fair-minded, impartial jury could very well have found them guilty given the material that was presented in the courtroom. The problem was that the material itself was tainted and ought not to have been presented as it was.
On the basis of the evidence produced at the trial, you would have to conclude that they were innocent. Certainly, you would have to say at most that the case against them is not proven.
Non a tutta parte arriva, professa quantità, ma se una bella cercala e parla grazia.
I think we should put this all in perspective. What makes the Sacco Vanzetti case important is the trial, the issue of how trials are conducted in an atmosphere of bigotry and oppression. Whether they were guilty or not is almost irrelevant if you're really talking about the issues that are raised about American society.
Another Galliani anarchist, Mario Buda, was also a suspect in the South Braintree murders, but he managed to elude arrest. Nevertheless, Buda was to have an unexpected impact on the trial. Shortly after Sacco and Vanzetti were indicted in the fall of 1920, Buda drove a horse-drawn wagon loaded with dynamite to the corner of Broad, Wall, and Nassau Streets in Manhattan. Here, next to a U.S. Treasury building and J.P. Morgan's offices, Buda set off a bomb just past noon on a Thursday. The streets were crowded with office workers. 33 people died, and hundreds were wounded in what was, until the Oklahoma City bombing, the worst act of terrorism on U.S. soil.
This was one of the worst instances of anarchist terrorism. The bombs that had been sent out in 1919, 1920, in virtually all cases, were directed at people who were responsible for the anti-radical legislation that had been passed, anti-immigrant legislation, for the persecution of Galliani himself and his movement, and a few famous industrialists thrown in there, like John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan. This was the first time in which a bomb was planted in a place that would injure what you would have to refer to as innocent people.
The Wall Street bombing was immediately blamed on anarchists and could not have helped the defense's case. Sacco and Vanzetti were found guilty of the South Braintree murders. After their conviction, Luigi Quintiliano visited Sacco and Vanzetti in prison to find out directly from them if they were guilty of the South Braintree murders.
So Vanzetti said to me, "Louis, I'm guilty of this as your father is." And you know, that impressed me. You know that my father was never in this country. So I embraced him, we kissed each other, and I kept on my mission in their defense. When I went to Nicola, Luigi said to me, "I'm guilty of this crime as my little Dante is." And Dante at that time was a little child.
During the next 6 years, new evidence discrediting the prosecution's case kept popping up. 9 separate appeals were made for a new trial. All were denied. Again, Richard Pollenberg.
Under Massachusetts law at the time, any challenges to the fairness of the trial or to trial procedures or to any aspect of the trial or any motions regarding new evidence that had been discovered would be heard by the trial judge, in this case, himself. So Judge Thayer, over a period of several years, was ruling on the fairness of a trial over which he had himself presided.
Judge Thayer didn't pass sentence on Sacco and Vanzetti until April 9, 1927. By this time, their case had become an international sensation, stirring the passions of famous writers like John Dos Passos and Edna St. Vincent Millay.
Well, I think there's no question that so many of these intellectuals were drawn to Vanzetti because he is this saint-like figure. He's an ascetic. Despite his broken English, comes up with these, you know, beautiful descriptions of his beliefs and of his life. One would have to say that there was also an element of radical chic here, too. Right? But on the other hand, there were people who almost devoted their lives to the case. And the United States was really torn apart
Sacco and Vanzetti were not unaware of the international sensation their case was causing. The following statement was attributed to Vanzetti by a sympathetic young journalist.
If it had not been for this thing, I might have lived out my life talking at street corners to scorning men. I might have died unmarked, unknown, a failure. Now we are not a failure. This is our career and our triumph. Never in our full life could we hope to do such work for tolerance, for justice, for man's understanding of man, as now we do by accident. Our words, our lives, our pains, nothing. The taking of our lives, lives of a good shoemaker and a poor fish peddler, all, that last moment belongs to us. That agony is our triumph.
Massachusetts Governor Alvin T. Fuller seemed to yield to the public outcry when he appointed a commission to investigate the fairness of the trial. Richard Pollenberg.
The Blue Ribbon Panel, consisting of three men, was chaired by A. Lawrence Lowell, the president of Harvard University. What's interesting is that even the most ardent partisans of Sacco and Vanzetti, some of them at least, thought that the Lowell Commission would do a fair job. Such was Lowell's prestige that people thought he would necessarily examine the evidence fairly and make a reasonable recommendation. Lowell, however, and his commission unanimously decided that the trial had been a fair trial and that there was no basis for extending clemency to Sacco and Vanzetti. This came as a great shock even to Sacco and Vanzetti's adherents. What is even more shocking is what we've discovered since, now that the records of the Lowell group have been opened. What is evident is that the commission began writing its report even before it had heard all of the evidence from Sacco and Vanzetti's side, hardly the kind of fair-minded, judicious proceeding that one would want to have. So it appears that Lowell and the others had their minds made up at some point along the way and then began writing their report even before all of the evidence was in.
Root Hog and I, friend Root Hog and I, gotta get to Boston, Root Hog and I. Sacco and Vanzetti die at sundown tonight, so I've gotta get to Boston, Root Hog and I.
The execution was scheduled for early in the morning of August 23, 1927. Boston had turned into an armed camp. Dozens of machine guns were mounted on the roof of Charlestown Prison. 800 policemen, carrying rifles with bayonets, blocked off the area. Protesters were arrested and jailed for carrying signs in support of Sacco and Vanzetti. Simultaneously, in New York, in Moscow, in Buenos Aires, Paris, London, and Rome, enormous crowds gathered, awaiting news from Boston. It was an international death watch. In the final days and hours, the defense made desperate attempts to obtain a stay of execution. Just minutes before Sacco and Vanzetti were scheduled to die, attorney Michael Musmano pleaded with one of the prison guards to let him into the so-called death house.
He says, no use of you going to try to see them because they're all ready to die now. You'll only excite them. I says, you're not speaking of two chickens. You're speaking of two human beings. You do not have to perform this execution tonight, because the warrant of execution reads any night of the week of August 22nd. And we still have an opportunity to get a reprieve. We have a week to work on a reprieve. So please don't do it tonight. And he says, no, no. He says, I have a job to perform, and I'm going to perform it. I said, but you can do it tomorrow night, the night after that. And then he made a revealing disclosure, the significance of which I don't think he realized. He says, no, I can't do that. Suppose I don't execute them. Or if someone granted a reprieve among all the hard-hearted judges in Boston, then the governor would say to him, well, why didn't you kill them last night? And now we wouldn't have this trouble tonight. And he started down the corridor, the steel corridor, toward the execution chamber. I at his side. Finally, he got to a door. He says, "You can't go any further."
40 years later, Luigi Quintiliano recalled the last minutes of Sacco and Vanzetti.
What happened with our friends? Nicola went by himself. He walked, he told the guards, "Don't touch me." He sat down in the chair, he made a little speech, said goodbye to his wife, said goodbye to his children, said goodbye to his friends, long life, anarchy, and he was ready, and he went. I can only imagine what Vanzetti went through in those few seconds between the time that he saw the lights in his cell trembling, telling him that his brother was gone, and the time that the guard came back to pick him. Well, his time came, he got up, he walked to the chair, he made a speech, he had the courage to say that he was forgiving some of the people who had done what was going to be done to him. He said goodbye to his friends, he shook hands with the guard, he shook hands with the ward, and he said, "Thank you," and he sat down to that beautiful expression of American civilization, the electric chair. In a few seconds, he was gone.
Historian Nunzio Pernacconi is a professor of history at Drexel University and the author of Italian Anarchism, which is published by Princeton University Press. He's currently writing a book about the anarchist Carlo Tresca. Richard Pollenberg is professor of history at Cornell University. He wrote the introduction to The Letters of Sacco and Vanzetti, which was recently reprinted in paperback by Penguin Books. Sacco's letters were read by Joe Grafossi, and Vanzetti's by Spiro Malas. The audio of Michael Musmano and Luigi Quintiliano was provided courtesy of Pacific Street Films. We'd really like to hear what you thought of this program. You can email us at thepast@banet.net. That's thepast, one word, @banet.net. Or you can write us at The Past Present, 524 East 13th Street, Suite D4, New York, New York, 10009. The Past Present was developed and produced by Curtis Fox. Research and production assistance by Michael Bornes-Ney. The audio archivist for The Past Present is Andy Lancet. The program was recorded and mixed by Paul Ruest at the Argo Network. Richard Pollenberg was recorded by Bert Reed at Cornell University. The Past Present is a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Funding for this program was provided by the Gladys Kreebold Delmas Foundation. Additional support by the New York Council for the Humanities, a state program of the National Endowment for the Humanities. For The Past Present, I'm Joanne Allen.